What we're talking about is late night and early morning low clouds. With a chance of fall, chance of showers into the afternoon, with variable high cloudiness and gusty winds. Gusty winds at times around the corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know, things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold blood. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including western region of my mental health. And the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerted, precarious emotional situation. Cold out there. Cold on a ticket taker's smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches covers the southern portion of my disposition. Yeah. There was no severe weather well into the afternoon, except for kind of a lone gust wind in the bedroom.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the French Connection. It is Friday, the 4th of March, and I am your host, Daryl Smith, The Witness. We've got a great show for you today. After the break, I've got a guest named Karen Parker Esquire from California. We're going to be talking to her about several important issues, and so we'll pick that up immediately after the first break here. But, you know, as usual, I'm scanning the news, and we're talking today a little bit about Hunter Thompson's friend confirms he was working on a White House call boy story. Well, Let's add a little pepper to this thing here. There was actually some reports not back in 2003 that this guy Gannon entertained Tony Blair. Now, I've got sources in England who have told me that there has been speculation that Tony runs around in a dress quite frequently. Not that that I have the burning evidence of it, but that has been a repeated rumor in Britain, so it would seem to fit if Gannon is doing private duty with Tony Blair, which he apparently did back in 2003, according to reports that were confirmed. So Gannon gets free access to him. Maybe they were playing Tickle and Giggle or something. I don't know what they were doing. But Hunter Thompson was coming out with a working paper on this whole call boy story. And I can imagine that the White House would kill you for that. I'm certain they have hit squads that would go out and do you in. I want to remind my listeners that I would never kill myself, so if I end up Arkansided, you'll know it was murder. So don't ever let anyone tell you otherwise. Truth is here today, we're talking about fascism in America on my site here. This is what really happens is the site I like to go to. You know, they bring together stuff from everywhere, these guys. They do a lot of my legwork for me, and it's a great place to get information. And they're talking here about, the free speech rights that we have are going down the tubes, guys. I can't help but wonder, as I was talking to my guest today in our private conversation, you know, I want to remind everybody that we've got a Homeland Security guy here that has just hired Yevgeny Primakov from the KGB and Marcus Wolf from the Stasi. And I can only imagine that free speech will only exist when no one cares what the speech is. And that seems to be the direction we're heading in. But as soon as you say something that someone cares about, your free speech rights are going to be curtailed. So, you know, we got to get the push on here, guys. Rooftops, scream it out loud while we still can. Get the word out. Tell your neighbors. Tell your friends. There's no time to delay. We got to get this word out. We'll be right back with you after the break with Karen Parker Esquire, and we got lots to talk about. So please stay with me.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the French Connection. I am your host, Daryl Smith, the witness. You can contact me with any questions or comments. Please do, in fact. Let me know where you're listening from. I really would like to know where my listeners are listening from, and I'll send you back something right away. You can contact me at iamthewitness@hotmail.com, and it'd be great to hear from you where you're listening from. And like I said, if you have any comments for me, I would love to hear them. We've got a guest today who has been over 20 years working with the United Nations, and you and I both know, my listeners know here, that we try to bring on views from all over the place here to kind of get the idea of all the different positions that are out there. So we brought on Karen Parker today, and Karen, she's a very very bright lady, and I want to welcome her to my show. Karen, are you here?
I am here.
Hi, Karen. Well, you know, one of the things I want to start with, Karen, is for you to give maybe a thumbnail sketch of your curriculum vitae for the listening public and give them an idea of some of the things you're involved in.
I'm happy to do that, Daryl. I'm an attorney. I specialize in armed conflict law and human rights. Most of my work focuses on the international human rights forums, such as at the United Nations, the Organization of American States, and Council of Europe. Armed conflict law, as you know, as I'm sure the listeners know, has three different components. One is the legality or illegality of military operations. The second, the legality or illegality of weaponry. And third, the protection of victims of armed conflict, roughly the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I do know is that after the trial of Nuremberg, the worst thing that a country could be convicted of and person could be convicted of is an invasion of another country. They didn't even convict anybody of genocide in that court proceeding. And the fact is that America actually has committed invasion in Panama, in Grenada, in Yugoslavia, in Iraq. In other words, we've committed the worst act that anybody has come up with in treaty, and no one's saying much about it. Do you have any information about that at all?
These are very frustrating events, of course. One of the things that I do is try to bring actions where I can against the United States for such actions. For instance, I filed at the Organization of American States on the Grenada situation because the United States attacked a hospital. The Organization of American States accepted the petition. It was actually the first petition accepted against the United States in any international forum. And it resulted in a $2.4 million state-of-the-art facility being built for the persons in Grenada. So in a sense, I got something back from the invasion. What we do in human rights law is we try to get something for the victims. We can't always stop invasions in advance, and we certainly cannot get other countries to take on violators of the right to peace. You're talking basically about the right to peace.
Right. Well,
you talk about what came out of Nuremberg.
Well, not only that, the sovereignty rights of an individual country that has not shown overt aggression against the invader.
Right. The United Nations Charter forbids aggressive wars.
Well, that whole concept plus
Nuremberg, the right to peace. But what we do in human rights, we try to salvage something for the victims. And in that case, we did get some benefits for the victims. I now have a case at the Organization of American States against the United States for attacking the hospitals, clinics, ambulances, medical personnel, and patients in Fallujah.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping to get some benefits for the victims in that situation.
Are there any victims left, I wonder?
Well, That's a problem, and even trying to get information is difficult, but we think we ought to be able to prevail in that one, considering the situation, how we prevailed in the Grenada case. We're also alleging the use of depleted uranium, which I know you've had as a topic this week.
Yeah.
One of the other areas that I'm involved with is these weapons, and of course depleted uranium weapons are horrible things. It's dreadful stuff. But I took that to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and its subcommission, and in fact the experts of the subcommission agreed with me that depleted uranium weapons are illegal. So we have maybe not many teeth in the law at this point, but we have the law on the books, and so we need to enforce it.
Well, you know, I'm going to go right into our the thing we talked about on our private call. You know, our unelected government and our poser president have been utilizing laws that or rules as they want, especially in regards to the United Nations, where if the United Nations is benefiting their picture of the world, they tout it on every broadcast that the United Nations, the United Nations, and then if it doesn't suit their, you know, their snapshot of how they want things to go, they say, oh, we don't trust the United Nations. In other words, they have a hypocrisy relating to anything United Nations. And I got to tell you, we talked about this as well. Many people within my listenership have great misgivings about the intent of the United Nations under the manipulative force of this criminal government we have running our country. So when you see that kind of manipulation going on of the UN by the United States, and you know, and then you see them using this hypocrisy and double standard, you might understand why a lot of people feel that the United Nations is not necessarily a good organization.
This is true. I think there are a lot of problems with the United Nations. Certainly, I agree with a lot of the assessments that I think some of your guests have posed during this week. Yet there are areas where, if you will, what we call the world citizenry, which are the human rights activists, et cetera, prevail, where the United States, for instance, is much more limited in what it can try to maneuver or go around. So, and I think that one of the main forums for that is in the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and its subcommission. Not to say they're perfect, not to say the United States and other governments don't try to manipulate, but it is a place where world citizenry has a strong voice and where standards evolve that can eventually be held up to the United States as well as other countries.
Well, wasn't that United Nations Commission chaired by Libya?
There is a rotating chairmanship on the Commission on Human Rights, and first it's an African country, then an Asian, then a Latin American, and what's called Western another in Eastern Europe. And when Africa's turn came up to chair it, the African bloc chose a woman, actually, ambassador from Libya, as the chair, and she was very impartial and very good chair.
Yeah.
Isn't it kind of odd that
a country like Libya, where there are almost no freedoms outside of what they're willing to allow you. I mean, not that our country is any better today, but I mean, it seems to me that's the height of hypocrisy, that somebody who would be touting human rights from a country that has none.
I think it was as much in respect for this particular person, who's a very, very fine woman. And, of course, in the long course of apartheid, in South Africa, Libya was very supportive of South Africa, and actually it was the South African government that forwarded the chairmanship of this particular person.
Well, yeah.
And it was up to the African countries to choose. We can call the African countries hypocritical, but that's the way it was. Unfortunately, the United States advertises this as if it's the whole UN system, and that the whole UN system is corrupt, without letting people know how the UN works. And I think particularly in the areas of human rights, it's very important that people understand how these systems work so that they cannot be manipulated by language coming out of particularly this administration.
Well, I do know a great deal about South Africa, and having had that country be taken over by a communist insurgency. And I do know also that, you know, they're living under a form of government that most of my listeners find aberrant, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've got a battle on our hands in our country, and I guess I'm not going to belabor that too much. What I do want to bring up, though, is you did mention that you've got a brief forwarded regarding the attack on the hospitals in Fallujah, and you talked about, could you give us some progress reports on that and what it really means to have this thing looked at in the forum that you're looking at it in?
Well, we have two aspects to the petition. One is that the hospitals indeed were attacked, and the other aspect is how they were attacked and if, in fact, depleted uranium or other prohibited weapons might have been used. We filed at the Organization of American States Inter-American Commission on Human Rights at a particularly interesting time politically, because the General Assembly of the Organization of American States had slapped the hands of the United States a bit over the Haitian situation, and the nearly hand-picked Secretary General of the OAS, handpicked by the United States, a former president of Costa Rica, had to resign after only 6 weeks in office because of scandals, corruption scandals at home. So the
nothing surprising about that, Karen. Nothing surprising about
nothing,
that, Karen.
No. Right now, it's, of course, at the before the Commission on Human Rights. The United States has a certain amount of time to answer back. We expect the United States will dangle that out for quite some time. I had a petition at the Organization of American States filed in 2003. The United States had 60 days to respond and finally responded just before the holiday season this year. So we expect the administration to show a certain amount of contempt for the forum. But we do expect to ultimately prevail. We do think that the pressure that the Latin American governments will put on the United States through this mechanism will bear some fruit, particularly for the victims in Fallujah. Obviously, we would like to get as much as possible to the victims in terms of medical care, in terms of improved facilities, repair of the hospitals, provision of ambulances, etc.
Well, we've got a break coming up, Karen. It's a great interview at this point. We've got lots more to come. Ladies and gentlemen, stick with us for more from Karen Parker. And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. And I am the witness. My name is Daryl Smith. The show is The French Connection, and we're in a great conversation with Karen Parker. Karen, after the half hour, we're going to actually take a few phone calls, if you don't mind.
That's okay.
Okay. I want to get right back into this. You know, here's the situation. You've been involved with the United Nations for over 20 years, and, you know, I have had several United Nations workers on here, and one of them was a very high-level person. And, you know, there is a move afoot in some people's minds, and I want to say that this is only speculation, that there is a possibility of Kofi Annan being replaced by somebody from our country, and it's just rumor.
Yes.
But lo and behold, some of the rumors have actually come true over these past couple of years. Nothing is outside of possibility. And that rumor has circulated around Bill Clinton. And which would frighten the heck out of anybody listening to this broadcast right now, because, anyway,
I think it would be a very bad move to replace Kofi Annan with an American. I think for the rest of the world, it would just advertise that the United States is, in fact, in charge at the United Nations. I'm not sure it would have a lot of effect in the human rights arena, however. As you know, my relationship United Nations is at a unique point. I don't deal with the main politics. We deal with trying to get help for victims and expose atrocities.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it would be a big mistake for the United Nations to be run by a former American president.
Well, I do, too. And, you know, have you ever worked on anything that went on in the Yugoslav theater?
Yes, the use of depleted uranium in that situation, particularly Kosovo and in areas of what's left of Yugoslavia, a certain amount with the various armed conflicts in the breaking up of the former Yugoslavia, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, etc.
You know, here's the whole thing. You know, I mean, you're in a field that's trying to do good for people, and I applaud that. When I've looked at what's gone on in the United Nations, I had a friend of mine whose father was the ambassador to the United States from Pakistan some years ago, and his mom worked at the UN, and there was all kinds of fraud going on over there. I lived in New York for 12 years.
Yeah.
And the stuff that I heard going on at that place was amazing to me. And then now we've got this Oil for Food program. We've got Kofi's son involved. We've got, kind of superficial investigations being done. We've got, and in other words, it seems the corruption in the United Nations seems to mirror quite well with the American corruption.
Yes, I think though if you get beyond scratching the surface of almost any political entity in the world, you will find massive corruption. You're going to find it in the United States. You're going to find it in France where you are. You're going to find it in Japan and Canada and Brazil, anywhere you go. And recognizing that, I still think that there is a utility in pushing the human rights and armed conflict law issues in the United Nations Human Rights Forum.
That may not be true, and here's my point. First of all, most of the profiteering going on in the UN is made off of human suffering, so that's not the same as other countries. Secondly, we do have the United Nations involved in child trafficking out of the Balkans and out of Central Africa. And we have the United Nations involved in some horrendous activities throughout the world, and that is not like other countries. Corruption on a building project is not the same as profiting or making money from human suffering, and that flies in the face of what you're trying to defend against, even. And, you know, when you think about little children being taken out of Kosovo area or out of the Balkans and sent into child slavery across the world and then having it lead back to the United Nations, that's scary.
It is. Human rights is an uphill battle, no question about it. But as I said, we got the United Nations expert body to agree that depleted uranium weapons are illegal. Now we just have to enforce that.
Well, can you
and
give me
just
those four
the other
points?
Day,
those
just,
4 points. I want you to talk about that.
Why is depleted uranium weapon? Why are they illegal? Well, first of all, weapons have to stay within the legal territory of the battle. In other words, there are off-limits locations in military operations. You can't fire on a hospital or a school or that kind of thing. Depleted uranium can't be contained. It spreads. It spreads off the legal field of battle, so it fails what we call the territory test.
Yeah.
Just think of it as being loose and you're trying to sweep it up, and you just can't sweep it up. You can't go running after all these little particles and say, oops, that's past the field of battle. One of the other principles for weapons is they have to stop when the war is over.
Yeah.
In other words, now you have a peace, you're going to sign a peace treaty, and you can't continue to have weapons that are killing people, and depleted uranium, of course, can't be turned off. You can't go with those little particles and say, okay, war is over, stop being radioactive.
Well, I'm sure the Americans would say, yes, it can be turned off after 4 billion years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And third, this is actually the original issue with weapons. Weapons can't be unduly inhumane. I know unduly is a sort of a fuzzy word, but a weapon that actually damages the gene pool and affects children, what we call afterborns, people born after the war is over in ways with physical deformities, etc., cannot possibly be called humane. Also causing cancer, etc. So it fails that. And the fourth test is environmental. You can't have a weapon that hurts the environment, and obviously spreading radioactivity harms the environment.
Well, we got another break, and right after that we're going to come back with a couple of phone calls for Karen. If you want to join in, it's 1-800-313-9443. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back. I'm a little sad to break off of Miles Davis for my listeners. I don't know how many people out there like Miles, but, I love jazz. So I hope you do too, Karen. We got a phone caller coming in. But before we take the phone caller, I want to let everybody know that they can contact me at iamthewitness@hotmail.com with comments, ideas. Just let me know where you're calling from. I would love to have that. The first caller we're going to go to, Karen, for some questions here is Ed in North Carolina. Ed, you're on the air with Karen Parker.
Hello, Karen. How are you?
Fine, Ed.
Good. It sounds like I need to enlist your services.
Oh.
Things you talk all the things you talked about in terms of what makes war legal, what kind of weapons can be used, et cetera, apply to us down here in the 10 southern states. We have a copy of the surrender letter of our governor on June 25th, 1868, which, as you know, peace was declared in the war of federal aggression in March of 1865 and then again in, I believe, October of 1865 when it covered Texas.
Mm-hmm.
The feds put troops down here to force the ratification of the 14th Amendment and gave us all new governments down here under at the point of a bayonet. And as you know, under Vattel and Locke, an unjust war creates no title. And we've restarted our state down here and are going to go to the Supreme Court to see if the feds somewhere in the Constitution had the right to attack sovereign southern states and replace their governments and create. There's actually been two North Carolinas admitted to the Union. The Supreme Court admits that. So
well, sounds like an interesting case. I can predict the outcome, however.
What's your prediction?
I'm predicting you'll lose.
So, in other words, we are not entitled to lawful government in the United States.
The United States appears to have made civil war in the United States illegal, whereas civil war under international law is not illegal.
Now explain that. They have made civil war in the United States illegal. When did they do that?
Well, you know that if you advocate severing the Union, that would be viewed as treason.
Oh, well, we absolutely do not want to sever the Union.
Uh-huh.
We actually want to put it back together.
Yeah.
As it was before they re-engineered the states' rights.
Correct. I mean, they came in and conquered the southern states in time of peace, not in time of war.
Uh-huh.
So how can that be? That doesn't sound legal or just, does it?
As I say, it's going to be an interesting case.
Well, like I say, we're talking to a number of people, Paragon Foundation and others. We have a pretty good legal team, which is mostly non-bar, because we're afraid when you let a bar lawyer ask the question to the Supreme Court, they always seem to ask a question that doesn't get a very important answer out.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a bar attorney involved so that we can get access to it. But, you know, you can't address human rights. You can't address the things you're going to try and address until you get a nation called the United States back under proper law. If you look at Senate Document 93-549 from 1973, the government admits that at least since the Civil War, major parts of the Constitution have been set aside, and we're operating under war powers.
Yes.
So,
well, I think Americans have a big battle in their hands trying to get the government back in hands of the people. I'm very concerned about this current administration. Some of the past administrations haven't been much better, but I think at this particular point we're poised to be losing more and more liberties. As we speak, and I'm very concerned about that.
So am I, Karen Bravo.
And are you looking towards the domestic issue at all, or are you all pretty
well? My training is more specifically in international human rights and armed conflict law.
But is there a way we could bring in this international? Karen, could we bring in the international court to force the United States government to take a look at this issue?
The United States didn't ratify the treaty on the International Criminal Court. And in order to bring the United States to the International Court of Justice, another country would have to do that. That's one of the problems with the international system. That does not mean, however, that what I do, say, over at the United Nations Human Rights Forum in Geneva, Switzerland, is irrelevant in the United States. Many of the actions are to try to get redress for U.S. violations and to get the United States itself to comply at home. And just this week, we had a Supreme Court decision on juvenile death penalty that reversed a 1988 decision, which said juvenile death sentences were okay. And in the course of that time, we were at the United Nations saying, you know, with the Convention on the Rights of the Child and with other instruments drafted, that it's not okay to execute people who are minors at the time of the crime. So this Supreme Court just this week pointed to those those actions at the United Nations and said the United States is bound by the rules of decency of the international community, and which is actually going back to the very first Supreme Court of the United States, which found the United States bound by the law of nations.
Well, I guess my final question, Karen, would be, what are the American people to do if, under law, both international, law of nations, our Constitution, everything, we are told that we are not entitled to operate under those laws anymore?
That's a very, very serious question. I think most Americans, certainly those listening to this program, need to really search deeply to find some way to fight back on these issues.
This is a huge concern.
It's becoming such a huge concern that it makes it more difficult to go to the United Nations and work on these issues, knowing how much trouble we are in at home. And maybe we should all be focusing on actions at home.
I mean, you know what the Declaration of Independence says about this issue, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this network, of course, is very significant. But I'm in contact with people all over the country who are all kind of coming to the same conclusion. It's time to abolish this government, which has become destructive of those ends, which are inalienable rights, liberty, et cetera.
Well, I can't decide. No one that I know will disagree with that, and I don't think Karen would at this point, looking at what they're doing. So.
No, I think the level of violations are so intense that impeachment is the only option. But one of the problems is that the Republicans control the Senate, and so the likelihood of an impeachment is pretty low.
Well, I don't know if that impeachment would change anything, though.
Well,
waiting for new elections, I think, is pretty futile because I don't think we can have fair elections anymore. I think the electronic machines can be programmed to take a few votes here and a few votes there. It's not really detectable. I have absolutely no confidence in voting and vote counting in the United States anymore. So, in a sense, you know, it's throw your hands up in despair unless you get members of Congress who are willing to really fight back for it.
Well, that's
and,
never
and I don't
happen.
Know where they are.
Karen, I got to tell you, war powers, I think most of this stuff sits with war powers. What we need to do is go back in our history, and we need to reverse the War Powers Act, which gave them the right to build these agencies. And this is the agency law that has gone out and issued thousands and thousands of laws and forced us to follow them and that laws that were never part of the American construct.
Right. I think the War Powers Act, in a sense, gives to the president what the Constitution did not.
Exactly.
But it was passed by members of Congress who were duped at the time. And today I think they're either still duped, in other words, they're not smart enough to see what's happening, or they're part of the problem.
Well,
we have a very serious problem.
If you bring articles of impeachment against the president and you bring them to Congress and Congress doesn't act, that is misprision of felony right there.
Yeah, we're in a serious situation because I don't think our politicians have the political will or the integrity to really fight for America. They passed, for instance, the Patriot Act without reading it. They passed a bill that takes away our rights without even reading it. And most of them do not understand how that takes away our rights.
The law protects that. Law is by the informed consent of the people. The only way they could vote for and approve that legislation is if there was informed consent. Those laws, the Patriot Acts, do not apply to me. You know, I'd have to go into court and back that up.
Yeah. You're going to certainly have a huge legal bill on your hands if you get arrested and you need to get counsel and try to defend yourself against Patriot Act actions.
Absolutely.
I think there are threats to civil liberties organizations in these lines. I think it's very possible that the administration may decide to bankrupt them all on legal fees.
But see, by arresting them, they have to defend themselves,
and they can't defend the people that they exist to defend.
But see, you need to learn your history, because civil liberty, civil rights, came out of the Civil War. Before that, we all had political rights and natural rights. Civil rights were a creation prior to the 14th Amendment to do some pretty dastardly things to U.S. citizenship. If bar attorneys would actually learn the law instead of procedures or taught in school, we have all the things we need, but we're playing their semantic game in court and losing. Now, I know that's a little harsh. I don't mean to be as harsh as that sounds.
Well, it's also getting a little bit away from my field. As I say, I don't take many what might be called civil rights cases in the United States. Most of what I do is focused on international forums because that's where my training is.
Yeah, well,
that's
we don't
where my
do
cases
civil
are.
Rights because nobody has – I don't want civil rights. Civil rights are something the government bestows that it can take away, and I don't want any of those.
Yeah.
So, Karen, thank you so much. It was a great conversation. I'll let somebody else get in here, but you confirm for everybody from a very astute and in-the-trenches viewpoint that we know what time it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Ed. Kyle in Missouri, you're up on the air with Karen Parker. Kyle?
Hi, Daryl.
How are you?
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kyle.
I wanted to, first off, recommend that a book, especially for the last caller, that would help him if he was going to be dealing with the legal system. It's called Adventures in Legal Land. And there's a website, adventuresinlegalland.com, and I'd really recommend that he looks. There's a short article called The Government Hoax there that I think he'd really enjoy, along with the rest of you. I wanted to I was reading an article the other day when I was listening to a show, and I thought this would be right up Karen's alley. In 1994 in Rwanda, the Tutsis, which were Christians, which they didn't mention that a lot in the news very much, had been disarmed by governmental decree in the early 90s. Then the Hutu-led military forces began to systematically massacre the defenseless Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
many of the Hutu are also Christian, by the way.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I'm not. You know, trying to make this.
I think the issue there was more ethnicity and control and power than it was religion. But that's my take on it.
Okay. Well, I the thing that struck me was that it says Madeleine Albright insisted the word genocide not be used in the United Nations forces stationed in Rwanda were not to be allowed to intervene because she said that they didn't want to get involved with a civil war, but actually it wasn't a civil war. It was a bunch of Hutus that were killing the Tutsis, which didn't have any weapons.
Well, it was a type of civil war, but there's absolutely no reason why the United States wouldn't want to get involved in civil wars. We do it all the time. So it was a bit hypocritical of Madeleine Albright to raise that point. And the United Nations system as a whole was pretty much raked over the coals for failing to intervene in a timely fashion on that situation. That's one of the huge tragedies in United Nations history. There are mistakes, and not moving faster on Rwanda was certainly one of them.
Okay. Well, why would the guy that was in charge of the UN at that time that allowed that awful thing to happen not be held up for ridicule afterwards? I mean, he was only slapped on the wrist, and he's still the Secretary General.
Yeah, but I think there's a misunderstanding of the power of the Secretary General. The Secretary General can't single-handedly invoke the powers that the Security Council holds in its hands. In other words, it's the government's will, not the Secretary General.
Bully pulpit, Karen.
Hmm?
He's got the bully pulpit.
He does have the bully pulpit, but he didn't have the Security Council.
He didn't have any backbone is what it was.
Well, neither did the governments in the Security Council.
Well,
the United States is very, very chary of the word genocide. I think they seem to want to hold it only for the European theater during World War II. They don't discuss it in terms of the Asian theater. And I think the situation in Rwanda was clearly one of genocide.
Oh, absolutely.
And there are other situations I would also call one of genocide. Unfortunately, United States State Department positions now are taking some of these civil wars, some of which are fought on ethnic grounds, labeling the ones we don't like as terrorists and counterterrorism, such as in Iran, sort of trying to shatter the import of humanitarian law, and then intimidating people who, for instance, the Iranian opposition.
Yeah.
You know, we put The State Department puts Iran on the axis of evil, but if you're trying to, if you're actually organized and you formed an armed force to try to topple it, you're a terrorist.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very serious situation. They're arresting Iranian Americans in the United States who wanted to support the efforts to try to topple the Ayatollahs for aiding and abetting terrorists. The Rwanda situation was tragic in its own way, but how the United States has mischaracterized conflicts, has not used the proper legal terms, which also includes the proper legal remedies, is truly tragic.
Well, Ed, Kyle, do you have other statement, another statement for Karen?
Oh, I just had one last thing to add on the situation. This article ends with this. At the end of the carnage in late July 1994, the American government rewarded the Hutu murderers with millions of dollars in foreign aid. Strangely, the American press has remained silent.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if you were aware of that. I didn't have anything to...
Yes, I'm certainly aware of the silence of the American press. It's so terribly manipulated, and I'm also aware of the situation because ultimately I think some of the United States... agenda is better carried out in their mind with Hutu than Tutsi.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Keep fighting the good fight, Kyle. Thank you.
Thank you, Daryl.
You know, Karen, we've got very well-educated listeners, as you can hear by the questions. And this is the radio network in the country that is really an earthquake for the government, trust me. And we got another short segment coming up after this break, Karen. You can think of something you want to close out the show with. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back with Karen Parker. With our guest Karen Parker. Before we go to Karen, I want to remind everybody that tomorrow's guest is Monday's guest is Ernest Sternglass, Dr. Ernest Sternglass. He is a real titan in his field of a polluted environment, in fact, in the nuclear area. And I'm looking forward to talking to Ernest Sternglass about what's happened to America's environment since the nuclear bomb was discovered. Also, you can contact me at iamthewitness@hotmail.com with any comments or questions. And I'm still looking for a sponsor for my airtime on shortwave. So let me know if you got anybody out there wanting to help me sponsor some airtime on shortwave. Karen, we're back with you, and I want to thank you very much for being a good sport about everything. You know, I told you I would try to challenge some of the positions of the UN, and I think I've done that pretty well. And you've done a good job of explaining your positions as well. And we have one more guest named David from Arkansas who wants to ask a question. David, you're on with Karen.
Hello, Karen.
Hi, David.
Well. You know, I believe totally what the caller before last was saying, that the Constitutional Republic was destroyed about 140-some years ago. And it's time that we do get back to the truth and let the bright light of truth shine forth and let the chips fall where they may. May I read a legal definition out of Black's Law 7?
Excuse me?
Okay, this is a legal definition out of Black's Law 7th, right of revolution, the inherent right of a people to cast out their rulers, change their polity, or effect radical reforms in their system of government or institutions by force or general uprising when the legal and constitutional methods of making such changes have proved inadequate or are so obstructed as to be unavailable.
Well, that seems to fit the formula that we've been looking at today, I think.
In international law, we call that a levée en masse, an uprising. It's interesting that the International Document for Human Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, also protects the right of rebellion against tyranny and oppression in its preamble.
Right. Well, Sections 29 and 30 of the so-called UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights is very instructive because they plainly state that the people only have the rights that we grant them. And, of course, there's no such thing as a Second Amendment in that Declaration of Rights. But here in Arkansas, we have a very powerful document. It's Article 2 of our state constitution, Declaration of Rights, with Section 29, all laws contrary to anything in this article are void, plain and simple. So it's time we did get back to lawful government, because our lawful government was already overthrown years and years and years ago.
I agree. I happen to agree with you, David, completely.
So if we are to ever get our country back, so to speak, then let's get control of ourselves first and be responsible for our own actions.
We certainly have to have an informed citizenry, and unfortunately we don't have an informed citizenry, so
we're kind of, as
my grandmother used to say, we're at sixes and sevens.
Well, that's been the total object of the so-called free public government school system.
Yep.
The total.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got the end of the show coming up. David, I want to thank you. Keep fighting the good fight.
Yeah, I'll
Karen, you know, Karen, I got to tell you, it was a very interesting hour. It went very quickly, didn't it?
It certainly did.
Well, you know, you're a wealth of information. I want to thank you for bringing up the issues of the rights for especially for children and human rights. And I want you to keep up the good work. And maybe you actually got a good idea of what kind of radio station RBN is. We've got some good stuff happening here, and I hope you can tell others about us. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everybody for listening today, and I am the witness. My name is Daryl Smith, and you've been listening to The French Connection, and I'm going to be with you next week on Monday for 2 hours, starting Monday, 2-hour show. So hang with me on Monday. We've got a great guest coming up and lots more to come. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.